Hey there, all you hip cats, cool kittens, you guys and dolls, you diesel-powered disciples of cool. This is the Diesel-Powered Podcast, the voice of Diesel Punk, and you are listening to the Agent Carter Roundtable. And I am your host, the artist also known as Big Daddy Cool, Johnny Della Rocca. Joining me via the magic of the interweb from Memphis, Tennessee, the daring darling of the skies, Daisy O'Dare.
What? Buzzing, cousin.
And from awesome New Orleans, the man, the myth, the legend, Ken Sharkey.
Greetings and salutations.
And all the way from Florida, we've got the author of Dragonfly, Charles A. Cornell.
Oh! Yeah. Thanks a lot.
And we are back for the roundtable this week, talking about episode number 3. And Ken, what was the title of this week's episode of Agent Carter?
Great. That's the one thing I didn't take notes on.
Let me do my Ken impression here. It was called Better Angels.
There you go. Yes. Wow, what an incredible likeness.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Well, you're the one who said you took notes.
Yeah, and apparently I wrote everything down but the title of the episode.
Well, they don't display it.
Yeah.
They don't? On Hulu they do.
Oh, okay, on Hulu.
Yeah.
Well, I watched it on TV last night, so I didn't get to that.
You know what? For the first time in maybe 2 years, I actually watched something live on broadcast, live at the scheduled time on broadcast TV. I've been a Netflix and Hulu guy for the last 2 years, but we bought an antenna, an HD antenna, and now we get HD broadcast TV. Yeah. And so for the first time in the longest time, I get to watch things like when they're actually happening. I was really beside myself.
Marvels of modern technology.
It is. You know, isn't it kind of funny, Charles, how everything old is new again?
Oh, yes. And this episode had some of that, for sure. Mm-hmm. I love some of the references, the little quips they made. We'll talk about them.
Yep.
Yeah, well, so Better Angels, and this is episode 3 of Agent Carter, and the big thrill for me, guys, was the return of Howard Stark.
Yes.
He is the coolest cat to walk the planet, in my opinion.
Inventor, movie mogul, playboy.
He's everything I've ever wanted to be in life.
And a scriptwriter's dream, because he can virtually say anything he wants. He's you know, talk about back in those days, you know, political correctness was everywhere, but he didn't care.
Yeah, so last night I was posting live as I watched it. And the very first thing that just blew my mind was the cameo by one of Marvel's original superheroes, mm-hmm. Kid Colt.
Mm-hmm. That was in a top shelf comic book in Stark's...
No, he was making a movie about Kid Colt.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yes.
The cowboy who comes out with the cow print vest and the very bright red, was it yellow shirt with a red
bandana? No, yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
See, you jumped right into Uber Geek version 4.
Well, I couldn't help it. So I love Westerns. I love comic books. And so the Marvel Westerns, which were the most popular comics of their day, when Marvel was publishing the Westerns, that was like the superhero comic book genre of the time. And Kid Colt, Rawhide Kid, and the Two Gun Kid were this trio that occasionally teamed up with sometimes the Warhawks, sometimes the Phantom Rider, now known as the first Ghost Rider, and Blackhawk. Not the DC Blackhawk, but a different Blackhawk, or Red Wolf, the Indian superhero. And basically, they were the Wild West's version of the Avengers. And Kid Colt was one of the three most popular, him, the Rawhide Kid, and Two Gun Kid. And he was certainly the most colorful. And so, yeah, right off the bat, right off the top of the episode, I went into Uber Geek because out steps Kid Colt.
You know who he also looks like? And with his colors reversed?
Yes, I do, but I want to hear you say it.
Woody?
Yeah.
From Toy Story.
That is exactly where my brain went, because I don't know who Kid Colt.
Well, and I think that's probably why they chose him. Because, you know, Agent Carter is a Disney property.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel Comics, you know, belong to Disney, and ABC is a Disney channel. And, you know, what better way to pay homage to one of their other properties in the Pixar universe than to pull in Kid Colt, who bears a very strong resemblance to Woody from Toy Story, or the other way around.
Right.
I thought it was a nice little touch.
Well, did you catch what Peggy Carter said about it?
I did.
I just love that. I mean, I love the little scripting they do. And she says, a movie based on a comic book, dreadful idea. That's wonderful. That's a dig at themselves, isn't it? They mm-hmm. have a way of turning the tables on themselves. So it's a great line.
Yeah, it was. It was. And so a lot of good stuff happened in this episode. And yeah, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, there were a lot of Easter eggs in this, but I as we recap the episode, I'll try and make where the Easter eggs that I noticed. I'll try and point them out. But that was definitely one of the big ones, the one that we just mentioned about Kid Colt.
Yeah, and you know, there was a major theme kind of overriding this entire episode. And you know, we had talked last week about how we thought, you know, the show had already kind of established and moved past the general attitude towards women in the era. But this episode seemed to come back to that theme with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we can talk more about it, but, you know, one of the most frustrating things for me about this episode is, here Peggy has proved herself over and over again. She's saved the day. She's, you know, she should be beyond and above reproach. And yet, here comes Chief Jack Thompson.
Hey, you won't believe the noise I made when I saw. It was sort of a not him again moment.
Well, busting her down.
Yeah.
And Daisy, I officially hate Chief Jack Thompson.
I'm not a fan of him neither. I don't know if I could go so far as to hate, but I get what you're saying, because when he started tearing into her again, I just thought, oh, hadn't he learned a thing? He hadn't learned a thing.
See, my take on this is that it amazed me how in a span of an hour with just his scenes, I hated him and pitied him all at the same time. Because, as you know, we'll get into, there was definitely some inner turmoil going on with him as well.
Yeah, you're right. Go ahead, Charles. Yeah.
And I think I think the whole thing here is obviously you've got to have conflict, and the obvious conflict is between the good guys and the bad guys. But you also have to have conflict within the good guy ranks in order to create a little bit of tension, and you've got to give the protagonist pull that protagonist back and have some setbacks going on. And this is a standard literary script writing thing, and I expected it. I think they overplayed it a little bit, and I think we're sensing here that, you know, this isn't quite realistic to the episodes, you know, the series before, where, you know, she has really saved the day. But I'm, you know, going back to what you said, Johnny, that, you know, we've got the whole era of women in post World War II coming back into play here, and I kind of think that that's kind of a driving force behind this as well. So I like it and I don't like it. I think it's overplayed, it's melodramatic, it's unrealistic to her past. But by the same token, it's the way in which this whole thing has been designed. You know, the underdog and the woman in a man's world in the post 1940s.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, she wasn't going to take it sitting down, so to speak. She got right in his face and called him a coward.
Not only did she call him a coward, but she brought up an interesting point that was brought up last season
about him being a paper war hero.
About basically folding to higher powers and hiding the truth in order to get a medal on his chest.
Oh, and we got stuff to say about that, don't we?
Well, lay it on us.
Well, I mean, that we didn't see more of that till closer to the end of the episode, but let me just say, Agent Thompson's new friend, I was looking at his jacket collar. I was looking for it. I'm just saying that much right now.
Hmm. So, we'll get to that. The premise, you know, we come back in, you know, the previous episode, we've had the explosion of the Zero Matter. We believe that, you know, they're questioning, you know, what happened to Wilkes and Frost, and, you know, Peggy is pretty confident that Wilkes has been killed. That's what we were led to believe at the end of the episode. Not sure about Whitney Frost, because as she stated, she must have survived because if celebrity even sneezes in Hollywood, the tabloids are all over it, and there's not been any news about her missing.
And they're all saying that Wilkes was a communist spy. That's the story the papers are giving.
Yeah, yeah. And and that's the story. Go ahead, Sharky.
Which was a easy thing to point fingers at when things went wrong back in that era, was that someone obviously had to be a communist infiltrator.
Yeah, you mean that? You mean with $50,000, a Russian passport, and airline tickets to Moscow hidden under the floorboards?
Oh, and also the pistol that killed two agents.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, it's not like, it's not like they were... they already suspected him of something because of the color of his skin, so this was a good thing to pin on him.
Now, someone help me with history here, and you know, because I'm just not that familiar with the immediate post-war communist Russia the way I should be. My grandparents were from, or my great-grandparents rather, were from the Soviet Union. They were from Odessa. I should be more well-versed on post-war Russia than I am. But would it have been common for a black man to be a Russian spy? Would the Russian communists embrace that?
I don't know, but accusing someone of being a Russian spy was basically the same thing as them actually being one, as far as the public eye was concerned. And, you know, accusations were already flying. I mean, we weren't really friends with Russia during the war. We fought together, but we were already kind of lining up to get tangled with them after the war.
Yeah, and Howard Stark was accused of being a communist spy.
Right.
In season one.
Yeah, I think this is playing into the history of, you know, when the nuclear secrets were stolen by the Rosenbergs, and there was a famous incident there where it kind of set off the whole communist under every bed kind of fear. And I agree with you, Johnny. I don't think that there would have been, in fact, to be honest with you, I don't think there would have been much to say about any major character in history at that time that was for or against America that was black. It was really not. I think this is just an element that Marvel's brought into this series that's different than what the history remembers it to be. As most, you know, as we've said in season one, most everyone went back to where they were before the war started. You know, women had to go back to being secretaries and housewives, men returning from the war. And I think that the blacks that had served so valiantly in the war were now back into, you know, basically an American apartheid environment. And so this is something very unique to have that kind of eminent person and obviously suspected of being a communist. It says is something unique in this story.
Yeah, and I'm not complaining about it. I'm curious more than anything. But yeah, so they accuse him of being a spy. Jack Thompson takes Peggy off the case, but she is determined to get to the bottom of the pin. And the one guy who would know about an elite secret society of wealthy industrialists just happens to be back in town. And Howard Stark recognizes the pin. What was the name of the club?
The Arena Club.
The Arena Club. And Peggy wants to infiltrate the club. Obviously, women are not allowed. It is men only. And what's the best way to get a woman into a men's only club than the plan that Howard Stark has? And it was brilliant.
Yeah, wasn't it just?
Oh, it was fantastic.
For those of you...
the guy picked... Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Daisy.
I distinctly remember the guy picking up the phone and calling security because they had a code pink.
That's right. For those of you who didn't see it, Howard Stark and Peggy and Jarvis just invaded the club with an army of beautiful women. And the only one complaining about that invasion was the attendant, the host.
Torrance or Terry.
That's right. Terry Torrance. He was appalled, but the rest of the guys kind of appreciated the attention.
Oh, well, yeah.
I would say so.
And I appreciated very much the outfit that they put Peggy Carter in for the scene.
Was that... Okay, Johnny, was that the Hills Are Alive?
The hills are alive in that dress you're wearing.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. As indeed. When I watched it the second time, I was like, Johnny.
I fell completely head over heels in love with her in that scene.
You mean you weren't already?
No, I was, but it was a deeper love.
Family friendly show. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I have a couple of problems with this episode, though. And it starts with that scene. Uh-huh. So, she sneaks into the council room as they're exiting. She, they've left the Council of Nine. And, you know, they have established that they're going to knock off the rival to Chadwick's Senate run, get him out of the race, let Chadwick go unopposed. They come out of the room. She sneaks in to plant a bug. And here's where the whole thing went off the rails for me in this scene. One, the bug isn't going to work because they've got some kind of technology you know, made it go kerflooey and start whistling and making noise. She has to destroy it. But in comes the muscle, and I can't remember the character's name. They gave him a name, and anyway.
Oh, I don't remember.
Yeah, but you know, he's the guy who actually is the one that killed the two agents to get the lady in the lake and framed Wilkes by putting the gun in his apartment. They don't say that specifically, but that's what they hint at, right? Mm-hmm. So he comes in and he just says there's something wrong here. He doesn't see Peggy, he doesn't hear Peggy, but you know, he's hanging out trying to figure out what's going on, and Peggy sneaks behind this chair and lights her hair bow on fire using the bug and tosses it under the table as a distraction to get out. Well, here's my thing.
Uh-huh. I want to see if you're going to say what I wrote in my notes.
One, she gets out clean, but Goon never comes back. I mean, surely he discovered that, one, there was a fire, and as soon as he saw the smoke or smelled the smoke, he would have seen that something was burning. He would have seen that it was a hair bow. He doesn't come back out into the main club going, hey, we got a problem. One of these dames, you know, started a fire in the inner chamber. I just had a real problem with that. You can?
What I wrote down after watching it a second time was, especially being that they were all, you know, all the ladies came in all dolled up, was that I was surprised that he could smell the smoke coming off the fake flower that she ignited. She obviously wasn't wearing any perfume. Otherwise, you think he would have smelled that.
That hadn't occurred to me, but that's a good point.
Yeah, my take on it is a little different. That whole scene to me was a device to create the evidence of the newspapers with tomorrow's date. They had to connect that, the fact that this group, this Council of Nine, were influencing or making up or somehow creating tomorrow's news, even publishing tomorrow's news, as, you know, one of the key drivers of the nefarious plot that they're involved in, and for her to discover it. And that whole thing was designed for her to do that. Once she'd done that, everything else was sort of irrelevant. And she got out of the place really fast. So, to me, they were trying to be a little pretty with, you know, fancy with the way in which she sneaks in and the way the suspense is building up, that she's under the table. Where is she? Does he, you know, is she going to get caught? There's that, all that kind of, you know, sort of almost detective noir horror kind of suspense that they're trying to build. And then she kind of gets up and then it's all over. But, you know, one of the things we haven't said so far is up until that point, how fast those scenes went. If you think back to season one and some of the other parts of the first two episodes in the premiere, they dwelled on some of those scenes, you know, for some time. These scenes, they move fast in this episode. They went from scene to scene to scene really, really quick, and they didn't really dwell on anything. And I think it's because they're trying to build up the story, you know, of this group of people and what they're doing. And the other thing is, those newspapers play a pivotal role in the, you know, the reveal later on in this episode, which we're going to talk about, which is where Jack gets a little bit of insight into the fact that he's wrong and Peggy's right.
To me, there was a very pivotal part played before the whole club scene with Stark and the lovely ladies, in which Thompson and Vernon had an interesting conversation, yeah. In which Thompson specifically said to Vernon that he basically had handled the case. Let's see what I wrote here. Mentions wrapping up the investigation without any controversy. Vernon mentions missing items. Thompson said the SSR doesn't hand out evidence. At which point, Vernon, looking dead into Thompson's eyes, it says that there are bigger fish than the SSR, and that this is now a case of national security. And you kind of get the feeling that there are bigger powers in play than the SSR in all this, just by that conversation. And you kind of see the way Thompson, after Vernon kind of tells him, you know, in a very matter-of-fact way, you know what I'm talking about, and then walks off, and you kind of see this expression on Thompson's face, like, what exactly have we gotten ourselves involved in?
Yeah, well, and we forgot to mention that, you know, between that those scenes, Thompson has seen the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knows what they're dealing with. So are you suggesting, Ken, that what's his name knew that Thompson had seen the film?
No, because Vernon actually asked Thompson later on, when Thompson hands over the film. Vernon asks him if he had seen it, at which point Thompson makes the quip, you know, unless it's got Rita Hayworth in it, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't interest me. And Vernon goes on to say that he's doing great. You know, if he could, he would give him a medal for, you know, for his efforts, which again plays into the whole medal thing again, which we have touched on with like last season. And tells, you know, Thompson that he is doing a great service to his country, at which point Thompson looks at Vernon and says, well, that's all I've ever wanted to do. But Thompson has lied to Vernon in that he has seen what's on the film. So this is the part where, yes, we have Thompson, who is obviously, you know, he treats Carter very poorly. He's, you know, he's always insulting Sousa about his, you know, his shirt and the way he's handling his position on the West Coast. And you begin to suspect that, or at least I did, that Thompson is running a game himself to try and figure out what's going on with this Vernon character.
Well, I think that there is some truth to that. I think Thompson is trying to figure out what Vernon you know, is really setting up and how he can factor into the play. He's looking at his place in the whole thing.
Yeah, and I think it's, we've got to look back on Jack Thompson's character as well. He's got one foot in the dark side, right? I mean, his character is one that is very egotistical, self-centered, clearly ambitious, and wanting to play in the same arena that all these power brokers play in. He's now got the head of SSR as part of his reward, and he wants more. So he's very ambitious. And I think that the conflict that he's got with Agent Carter, which to me is getting a little bit contrived, but is there in order to set him apart from the rest of the good guys, in that he's got one foot on the light side of the force and the other in the dark side. And we've got this conflict going on with him as a character that makes it interesting. It's a subplot, and it's clearly weaves the major plot together. And this is where later on in the episode, it's actually Thompson that figures out that he's been played by this director of the FBI.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I did like the dialogue with Carter and Thompson at certain points in this episode. I loved the fact that even though she wasn't there, she pointed out how Dottie had rearranged the furniture on top of his sternum.
Yeah, that was a classic line too, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, news travels fast, don't it?
And another thing too that you had brought up earlier about showing women, unfortunately, how what their positions were in society at this time. We also had Frost telling Chadwick she wanted to retire from movies, and Chadwick basically telling her, well, you want to do this after my Senate race, correct? Chadwick tries to convince her that, you know, that probably would not be the best idea until after his Senate race, because they could only deal with one headline at a time. And then he leans over to her very patronizingly and tells her that, you know, once they make it to Washington, she can have all the babies she wants.
Yeah. So let's talk about Whitney Frost for a minute. It's Jack Sousa who discovers that Whitney Frost is not who she appears to be. And he's the one who discovers that not only is she a super starlet, but she's a super scientist.
Yes. Miss Agnes Cully.
And she invented, you know, it reminded me when they were describing her and what she created, and it reminded me of Hedy Lamarr.
It's basically who she is.
Yeah.
But evil.
Yes. And that's when they discover she is the one, the not just the money, but the brains behind Isodyne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's created radio frequency modulators. And for any of you listeners who really want some interesting history, I would dare say look up Hedy Lamarr and do so on your cell phone, because you will have a great appreciation for this woman while you're looking this up on your cell phone or your smartphone, because basically Hedy Lamarr is the reason, or one of the reasons, that we have cell phones today.
That's right. it's pretty remarkable. Pretty mm-hmm. remarkable.
And she got very little notice because she was a female. It wasn't until the 90s that she, you know, different scientific and different communities that deal with wireless communication finally started to recognize her.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's pretty remarkable, pretty remarkable. Well, and just a few minutes later, we would discover that, one of the side effects that Peggy, Carter has encountered is this like anti-gravitational field around her, or anti-magnetic field. I wasn't really sure what that was. And this is, again, kind of a scene and kind of a part where I had a little bit of trouble. And that was discovering, this is a spoiler for everybody, that Dr. Wilkes did not die, that he was still alive, just in an incorporeal form and invisible and inaudible. And it took Howard Stark and his super genius to, and his experience using light and emulsion on film to make Dr. Wilkes visible and audible again. That kind of, I don't know, it seemed a little bit silly to me, Charles.
Oh, I don't think so. This is Amazing Stories, right? I mean, this is very much, you know, what we're treated to in Agent Carter, which draws me to it, is this this blending of this real kind of retro, almost detective style story in full color, obviously, with the history of America in such. You know, we haven't said this, but even in the opening scene in that house, the attention to detail in the sets that this production has focused on is for that period has been remarkable. And I think that what we're seeing here is this idea that we brought a Pulp Fiction comic book to life. And when you look at, you know, how they're dressed and how they're, you know, the cars and the architecture and everything else. And then all of a sudden, something completely wacko occurs. Like, people turn into chunks of black ice, or you spray, which, by the way, you know, the sprayer wasn't, you know, something out of today's science. It looked like an old fashioned bug sprayer that Tony Stark had found in the garden. I'm sorry, Howard Stark had found in the garden, right? And filled with this silver nitrate solution, they had this complicated, baffling explanation of what the hell this was in relation to photography. But the bottom line of it is he sprays the air, and magically we see Wilkes come out of the ether. And, of course, you can't touch him. You put your hand through him. And that whole idea of how he can be there but not be there, it can be seen but not seen, it's just an amazing story. And that goes right back to those pulp comics. It's terrific. I that was my favorite part, actually. I thought that was ingenious. I was wondering how they were going to bring him back, because if you'd have done it any other way, if you'd have really done it the way modern science fiction writers do it, it would be very I don't know how to put words to it, but it would be sort of like he would dissolve. There would be some sort of dimension. No. Don't forget that. Forget that. All we got to do is put some liquid in a bug sprayer, spray the air, and bang, he's there. Right? It's terrific. Very camp. Very, very a classic noir in the whole thing.
I love that he also had to spray his vocal cords in order for it to So they could hear him.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
And I'll be honest with you, Johnny.
How else would you do it?
Right. I had less problem with this then when Vernon turned to Thompson at the end of their conversation and said, let's do lunch. I guess that's what they say here. Because for me, let's do lunch is more of a modern term. So that kind of momentarily kind of ruined my immersion, I guess, for a minute.
They're taking a lot of that. They did it in the first 2 hour premiere. They bring in a little bit of jabs to remind everybody that this is retro, but you know what? We're going to just poke fun at ourselves. And one of the things that I picked out that I thought was hilarious was when they talked about getting some Velveeta cheese.
Oh, that was.
We're going to mention that. And I can't remember the exact comment that he made, but it had something to do with, oh yes, it's supposedly good for fondues. I'll get 2 bricks. You know, it's like hilarious.
That was funny.
Fun at the whole. And this is retrofuturism, isn't it? Is to them that was the future. Velveeta cheese was something that, you know, was a new invention. And what can we imagine this thing being? This must be something that you can, you know, have a fondue with, and we look back and say and laugh.
Yeah. Okay. So, Charles, you may have converted me on that on the emulsion thing. So, I'll reconsider it and as not being so silly.
It's essential. It's essential.
So think of
the atmosphere of the retrofuturistic punk that we love as a, you know, a genre here. This is what it's supposed to be doing.
Well, okay, I am going to go back to this though, because it does frustrate me that they didn't resolve the issue of that field around Peggy. Was that field created because Wilkes was shadowing her?
Yes.
Yeah, he said that explicitly. He said he'd been trying to get in contact with her, and, you know, kind of like in a way, they're sort of trying to put a scientific spin on what a ghost is, because if you remember too, sprinkled not only in this episode but in the previous premiere, there was all these keys and pens dangling in the air, right? And they're very ghost-like. It's just, and obviously he was picking them up. That's what you can infer to be able to say, hey, I'm here. And
I actually picked up that exact same idea, Charles, was, you know, a Marvel sci-fi diesel punk way of explaining ghosts.
Huh. Yeah, so here's the other thing. You know, he says to Peggy, I've been shadowing you for several days. I've been right beside you for several days. Does it not occur to Peggy that he's been with her in the shower? Or, you know what I'm saying?
We'll treat that comment with the contempt it deserves. Yeah, well, okay.
I mean, it doesn't seem shocking to her at all.
Something tells me that Wilkes is a gentleman is a gentleman enough that he would have excused himself from such activities as peeping on Carter while she is in the moments of disrobing or cleansing herself. You, on the other hand, Johnny, you would have taken full advantage of your abilities.
Oh, that's the only reason I want to be invisible.
Yeah. Johnny wouldn't be Casper. He would be a poltergeist.
Yeah, no, look. He's a man. Come on. Gentlemen or no?
Don't do that.
Oh, hey, look who got back in.
I got back in just...
Is she back in?
Yeah, she's breaking up though, but that's all right.
I blame Hydra.
Yeah, I've got a bad feeling about this recording tonight. We've been plagued with some gremlins, and I've been having to start and restart the recording as we've gone along. I don't know what's up and down right now, so this is going to be fun to edit. But let's go ahead and skip here to our finale.
Before you do so,
okay.
Don't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
But one of the other Easter eggs I did want to point out.
Okay.
Not sure if you caught it, but when Wilkes and Stark are working together in the lab, there's two possible Easter eggs here. Stark mentions that he has to go to Peru. Do you remember why he had to go to Peru?
Yeah, there was an expert there.
Abner what was his Brody? Name? Abner Brody?
Does the name Brody sound familiar?
Wait a minute. Abner Brody?
Yeah.
Dr. Abner Brody in Peru?
In Peru? Deepest, darkest Peru.
You tell me, Ken, what you think that's an Easter egg for.
I think it was a nod to Indiana Jones.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. As soon as you said Abner Brody, I was like, holy crap. He's going to see... We're tying into Indiana Jones now, which is entirely possible because
of the time period.
Well, and because of the ownership of the property. Disney owns Marvel. Disney owns Lucasfilm. There is a new Indiana Jones movie coming. A fifth one, and there has been some definite discussion about the Disney, Marvel, Lucas, and Pixar universes overlapping. It's something that they are working towards.
Well, and isn't that a good thing for Dieselpunk? Because didn't Indiana Jones really put a face on Dieselpunk to the general population, which is really good, because obviously we love Agent Carter for that, but we go back to the Rocketeer and Indiana Jones for all of our origins when it comes to you know, cinematic Dieselpunk.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Now they're coming full circle back to it.
Well, okay, so we had the Abner Brody, but there is also something else that pops up when Stark starts talking about how he has to find his passport, and he kind of disappears off screen. Did you notice that the camera stayed in place?
No.
Pointing at the window.
No. What was that?
The stained glass window looked like Iron Man's arc, center of his chest.
The arc reactor.
Mm-hmm.
I missed that.
And what pointed it out to me was the fact that when he walks off and the camera just stayed there for a beat. And then, you know, it dissolves to the commercial or next scene, or I can't remember exactly, but yeah.
Yeah, it kind of validates my, like, pseudoscience theory that we've got two streams of consciousness going through these shows. It's one for the people who are like drill down deep aficionados of the Marvel universe, and then there's ones for people like me that just want to see a good story and a pretty girl and you know, bug sprayers creating ghosts and stuff.
Well, so. We've seen a couple of things happen here. One, we've seen the zero matter affect people differently. Mm-hmm. You know, it's turned Dr. Wilkes into a ghost, but it did something entirely different to Whitney Frost.
Yes.
At the end of the second episode, we saw the kind of the cut on her forehead that she's covered up with her hairline, and we see the dark matter kind of under her skin through that cut. And here at the end, the director comes in, trying to cop a feel, sees the scratch, the gash, whatever we want to call it, and makes the horrible mistake of touching it. And he goes, go ahead, Ken.
He actually freaks out and she grabs him.
So he didn't really touch the matter.
No, he was more freaking out because his, star that he had just gone to bat for, against the movie studio who wanted to drop her, has a blemish on her, perfect face. And so he starts to freak out, and she basically grabs his arm, and I'll let you finish off there.
Yeah. So it was his visit did not end well for him.
No.
Because he is engulfed by the zero matter and then absorbed into Whitney Frost.
Brings a whole new meaning to Maneater.
Yeah. Black Widow.
Yeah. So, I don't know where that's going to... That's such a horrifying, powerful ability, I guess. And, she is now a living weapon.
Mm-hmm.
A living zero matter reactor.
Yeah, and it really adds to the mystery of that whole concept, because Wilkes, obviously, we saw him, literally disappear, and then he reappears without any substance, whereas she's very much got this substance, and she's actually a channel for it. She, as you say, she's weaponized, and that really sets apart, where she's going to play a future role in the coming episodes. But then the big question mark is, well, how is Wilkes ever going to get back to being whole? Is he ever going to get back to being whole? So, good questions to leave open for the viewer to ponder as we go into the next round.
And we also noticed too that after she has used this ability, the scar on her head has gotten bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Something funky happened with her veins on her arm too. So she's obviously, I don't know whether she's morphing into something less human or whether it's always going to be hidden and brought out with these sort of. It's almost like when she gets angry or something, she comes through.
Which is interesting, Johnny, because as you and I know, as uber geeks, that scar, if the scar continues to progress, she will have to use a mask.
Mm. Yeah, that's where I see that going, and that mask may actually be not just to conceal, but to contain.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, you piqued my curiosity when you mentioned Abner Brody. So I went to Wikipedia,
mm-hmm.
and the character in Indiana Jones is actually Abner Ravenwood.
Oh.
And Marcus Brody. So they're two different characters, but it's not a direct Easter egg to Indiana Jones, but I think it is a nod. And I think they did it intentionally to make us think that way, because you remember in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, the character of Harold Oxley, they called Ox, was working to find El Dorado and was in Peru at one point. That's where he found one of the crystal skulls.
Oh, okay.
So all of those three elements separately, when you put them together, it may have been an intentional nod to Indiana Jones. It may have been completely coincidental.
Interesting.
Yeah. But good catch, though, anyway.
Yeah, because as soon as I heard the name, I was like, wait a minute, I know that name. I know Brody.
Well, I thought the exact same thing when you said it. As soon as you said it, I said, holy crap, that's Indiana Jones. And then, but something was just itching at the back of my skull. And I know if I hadn't researched it and corrected us, that we would have got email on it.
Well, we appreciate email anyways.
Yes, yes, we love email. And people can send us email at feedback@dieselpoweredpodcast.com. Well, so guys, next week is another episode, and they've already teased more use by Whitney Frost of this zero matter power in the previews. And I don't even know as a writer, Charles, where I would go with that.
I think we can go anywhere, and we were surprised last season as well, with they're going to make a departure here. They're not going to let us be comfortable in our ability to add two and two and make four. They're going to start, you know, going a little bit more into the amazing story of Zero Matter. I'm pretty confident of that.
Yeah, and before we leave here, Ken, I want to come back to one of the comments that you made at the beginning when we were talking about Agent Jack Thompson, how in this episode you both hated and pitied him in the span of an hour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he starts by busting down Peggy Carter. Then he sees the film. Then you get the feeling he feels a little bit queasy about Vernon and the secrets they're keeping. And then he goes to the arena club and he sees the very piece of evidence that yep. he swore up and down could not exist. He sees the newspaper and you're right. You saw it in his eyes. Whether it was remorse or guilt or, you know, realization, all of the above.
It's you know what it is, Johnny? It's shame. He's ashamed of himself for A, being so skeptical, and B, being so stupid.
Yeah, and there's an interesting scene that happens very quickly. That looking, like, thinking back on, I mean, it dawns on me that, you know, he has put up this front of the hardened chief and everything like that, and he's got no way to express it, and I think that's why he was trying to get Sosa to go out and have drinks with him. Because there's that scene, and it didn't really, like, I was kind of like, well, this is a strange kind of, like, twist in the character that, you know, you've been poking fun, you've been hard on Carter, you're making fun of, you know, the West Coast Bureau and everything like that, and then there's this moment of, hey, can you show me that frolic room that, you know, that you that I hear rave reviews about? And it's almost like this moment of, I might be over my head, I need to talk to somebody. And unfortunately, you know, he gets kind of the cold shoulder and is just kind of left to his own, you know, his own devices at that point. And that's kind of the whole culmination of, wow, this guy's a jerk. Oh, wow. I feel bad for him because he may have bitten off more than he could chew.
You know? There's a sense to me that he's been promoted to his level of incompetence, and he's starting to realize it himself. He's play-acting the big boss, the big cheese, and know-it-all, the big I am. And every time he gets some of these things, you know, rubbed into his face, he's realizing that he's really just a guy like he wants to be back where he was, an agent on the beat, you know, knocking heads. He likes the interrogation room and all that kind of stuff. He's uncomfortable being the boss.
Yeah, I think he is. You know, he mentioned it in the first episode interrogating Dottie, you know? He was the stick.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't like being the carrot.
Well, I think there's a struggle there. I think there's a struggle because, you know, like Charles was saying, he wants to be the beat. You know, back on the beat, he's got this position of power, and he's also being told that basically he is no longer really useful by Vernon. You know, that the SSR is basically kind of obsolete, and it's a struggle of, you know, he wants to be important. He thrives off of kind of that position of power, and yet there's this inner turmoil where he just wants to be him, though, too. And
you bring up a really great point, because, you know, when you think about it, who needs him? The people that he wants to ingratiate himself to and become a part of, their inner circle of power, this secret, you know, national security government that's represented by the FBI, they don't really need him. They don't really want him. They want him shut up. He's just like in the mafia, just a guy that needs to, you know, put a lid on it, go follow orders. And then when it comes to his agents, and with Sousa in particular, who really pretty much says to his face, you know, I'm my own boss here. What are you doing here, Jack? And then of course Peggy, she's center stage in the whole thing, and he's just really taking a back seat in his own investigation, and that's got to irk him. And he's at a loose end. I kind of sense in a way that they're setting up this thing to somehow end the way the last season ended with the chief Dooley, right? He's got to have to do something really heroic to bring himself back up in his own eyes, first of all, and in the eyes of everyone around him. And let's hope that happens.
Yeah, I think they're setting him up to be the hero at the end, but along the way, they're going to make us hate him.
Of course. They got some good script writing in this whole thing. And let's not forget, we've passed by one of the most important parts of this whole episode, and that is the bargain that Carter made with Wilkes for him to stay, because he didn't want to stick around. And that interplay, that whole dialogue interplay between her and him, and the love interest is obviously rekindled by his reappearance. That was a really brilliant bit of dialogue. You know, we really got hooked into that whole thing again, where she really bargains with him to stay around and be part of her future.
Yeah, good stuff. Any final thoughts on this episode before we say goodnight?
It's just shaping up to be another great, intelligent, well-designed story with great sets, great acting. Yeah, it's a little cheesy in some places, like the Velveeta was. But on the other hand, I mean, the Velveeta in this episode was like the flamingo in the last one, right? You have to have that.
To see that.
Yeah, you know. But you know what? That's the campiness that we're looking for that makes this whole thing so different. And the production value, the visual value, the gorgeous girls, the fashions, the sets, the architecture, the cars. This is what makes this series so magnetic to people like me, who are saying, hey, this is a this was part of our history, and they brought it back alive in Technicolor, in living color. And, you know, as Ken's been saying, bringing all these little nuggets of the technology and the, what happened in those days back to a modern audience, jazzing it up with a sexy heroine, fantastic special effects, an intriguing plot, there's mystery, there's suspense, it's a thriller, all rolled into one. They even, for goodness sakes, they even brought a Western into it. I mean, what more can they do to make this thing visually appealing and different?
And those listening devices could not be any more diesel punk.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. So, I mean, you know, all you need is a bug sprayer, Johnny. Bug sprayer, some Velveeta cheese, and a flamingo.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? I think you're right, Charles. That sounds like a joke.
I want every single one of Sousa's Hawaiian shirts.
You know, so interesting thing, because Jack comments on that, right?
Yeah.
He says, nice shirt. In season one, I was envious of Sousa's sweater vests that he wore under his suit. Yeah, and I mean, perfectly matched to the style that he had on. And I mean, I want to know how he kept his gig line so sharp. I mean, there's some starch there, right?
Right.
Because I'm a big fan of that whole look. And
I want shares in the sunglass company that makes Peggy sunglasses.
but this season, I'm digging Sousa's style again with the more casual California.
Yeah.
Look, yeah. I have a place in my heart for that character. He is the most relatable character of the whole show. And I don't know if other people feel that way, but I really feel like he represents me in that universe. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
No, it does perfectly. I again, like I said, you know, the first season, I think he is such a great, brave character to have been written into a story like this. You know, someone who has, you know, I don't like to use the word handicap, but you know that he is still, even though he's like the chief, you know, he's still out there. Even though he's got, you know, a pistol in one hand and a crutch in the other, and he's still, you know, kicking butt. And then on top of that, there's just that very human side of him where, you know, when you saw him see Peggy again, you know, for the first time, when he tells Thompson in this last episode, because Thompson kind of ribs him a bit about, oh, so, you know, made you move all the way to the West Coast because you got your heart broken, huh? And he's like, well, actually, I'm engaged. You know, there's very human, relatable qualities about him. You know, the fact that he gets picked on, but yet, you know, he is probably much stronger than Thompson. And the fact that he's incredibly loyal to Carter, you know, I think we see a lot of ourselves in him, or we see a lot of qualities that make us feel a lot better because we share them with him. You know, he's the good guy. You know, he's the guy that you would want to invite out to a bar and have a couple drinks with. He's the guy that you want to chew the fat with. You know, I would even dare say that, you know, maybe the reason why his agents in his department might be a little greener than the East Coast is that because he's not such a hard ass. You know, he will, you know, actually take the time. They're not, I'm not saying that they're less incompetent, but he definitely has a different style of management than Thompson has. And I think his agents are probably more loyal than the East Coast agents, because he would be the kind of boss that would come up and be like, okay, you messed up here. How can we work on it together to fix it? Whereas Thompson would be like, you know, you knucklehead, you know, this is all your fault.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, and for me, Johnny, my favorite characters other than Peggy Carter, obviously, we can't forget her as a star, but I love the femme fatales. I love Dottie Underwood. Can't wait to see her again. And I'm now loving Whitney Frost. I mean, is there anything more evil than a woman that can turn you to black ice? I mean, I just love it. And they've done a great job. There's not a lot of female villains in cinema or in modern television shows. You know, there's a lot of female protagonists coming in, the good guys. But, you know, somebody that's really, really evil but pretty evil. These two have got it going on, and, you know, I can't wait to see them again.
You know, that's a good point, Charles. Although the place where female evil antagonists do exist, largely in cinema and pop culture, is in the Disney animated films. And here we have a Disney-owned property.
Oh yeah, like the whatchamacallit in Little Mermaid.
That
kind of thing. Yeah.
And you've got Cruella de Vil. You've got Queen and Sleeping Beauty. You've got Maleficent. Disney is.
Yeah, it's interesting. Is that a product of the merger? Do you think?
I don't know.
Writers who probably transitioned from being a Disney scriptwriter to a Marvel scriptwriter in some way. You know, we don't know all of the background back office stuff, but maybe they're bringing in that influence. But I think they've done a great job of those characters. I mean, the actors that play them are dynamite.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are beautiful evil. I mean, you know, one minute you want to kiss them, the next minute, you know, you're getting your want a string of garlic around your neck, you know?
I did miss Mrs. Jarvis.
Yeah. Anna wasn't in this one.
Yeah.
By the way, and can I, another point, sorry, I know we're trying to wrap this up. Another point that just dawned on me. Can Stark, another Easter egg that I just remembered. Stark really needs to figure out his security system. Okay, because we're doing again in the second season, so we're breaking into his place.
Yeah.
The best part of this is Jarvis.
Flat on his back.
The security system saying, I don't want to be known as a disembodied voice forever.
Oh, yes.
And what does Jarvis become?
A disembodied voice in the Iron Man movies,
He becomes Tony Stark's AI. Right, so...
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. I missed that.
And that's a bit incredulous, don't you think? I mean, Howard Stark invents all these things and these, you know, technology and, you know, it's just the craziest thing. He doesn't even have an alarm system or, I don't know.
Well, or maybe it points to his arrogance.
Possibly.
Yeah.
But again, I think that was a plot device in order to allow a would-be assassin to sneak in. And,
oh, of course. You
know, yeah.
Of course.
But he really needs to fix. I mean, he needs to come up with something.
Either that needs to buy a big black dog.
Excellent. Well, guys, this was another fun episode and another great roundtable, and I appreciate you joining me and talking about our favorite TV show right now, and we'll do it again next week. Of course, sorry that Daisy had to drop off. Hopefully we can resolve her internet problems for next week and not have any issues. So if you're listening and you like what you hear, tell your friends. Tell 200-300 of your closest friends and family. Visit our sponsors, Comic Bento, They do a mystery box of comics and graphic novels every month in your mailbox. Mine will be here this Friday. I can't wait. But it's at least $50 worth of comics for less than $20. And if you tell them we sent you by going to mycomicbento.com, if you sign up, it helps us. Helps us keep the lights on and keep the broadcast system rolling. Also, you can help us out by checking out Audible at audibletrial.com/dieselpoweredpodcast. If you're into audiobooks or old-time radio programs, great speeches, that's the place. And you can go to audibletrial.com/dieselpoweredpodcast and try one of their over 100,000 titles free just for checking them out, and it's yours to keep. And I have a great recommendation for your free book, Tales from the Flip Side by John Pica. It is available at audible.com as an audiobook produced by Radio Classics. So yeah, check that out, and that'll be great. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. And guys, on behalf of Ken Sharkey, Daisy O'Dare, and Charles Cornell, this is John Pica, also known as Big Daddy Cool, Johnny Della Rocca, saying swing hard, swing often, and we'll catch you on the flip side.